Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Posey. Delighted to have you with us. We've got a very special guest today, all the way from the West Coast, Patricia Niehaus. She is president of the Federal Managers Association and has agreed to talk to us about the theme being Take Me to Your Leader. Pat, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Mike.
Hey, a little background. Tell us, will you please, what you do and where you come from in real life?
Okay. I'm the chief of the Labor and Employee Relations Section at Travis Air Force Base in California, Northern California. And I'm also the national president of the Federal Managers Association.
In your spare time.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, that's great. Well, you obviously know wherever you speak with a title like that. Pat, I remember years back, and I probably don't want to remember which president it would date me, but somebody at the White House decided there were too many managers and supervisors in the government. They came up with a ratio. I think they said there were 7-1 or 8-1, something like that, and it should indeed be 16-1, which is a totally arbitrary number, but they wanted to make some reforms. And what happened was in the government, my recollection is that in many cases agencies looked at the situation, realized they couldn't get by with fewer managers and supervisors than they had, that they were sort of bare bones as it was, so they just changed their titles.
Yes, we went to a lot of people are now, their titles are now leads or leaders as opposed to supervisor or manager.
Okay, so that's the way we solve things in Washington. Well, that's fascinating, the way things are done. Pat, you represent managers. What is a manager or a leader today in government? What kind of people are we talking about and what sort of grades?
Depending on the agency and the career field, it could range from a GS-7 to an SES. Employee, it could be a wage supervisor. We also have the category of wage leaders for the blue-collar workers.
Okay, and I would assume that the majority are in the Defense Department simply because it's the biggest federal agency.
Yes, and I think most of the wage employees are in the Defense Department, too.
Okay, about 230,000. Have you been keeping track on the pay raise or, I guess, lack of same for the wage-grade employees?
Yes, we have. We've been actively advocating parity in that respect, and I know there are a couple of bills in Congress right now being pushed to bring them up to parity with the GS employees.
Okay, and wage grade for people who don't know, these are skilled trades, carpenters, mechanics.
Aircraft mechanics.
Right, air conditioning people. In the term of blue collar, it's not what you normally think of.
No, they're highly skilled employees. I mean, in some career fields, it takes several years for them to get to the journeyman level.
Okay. Now, you're in town today for, and I probably get the title wrong, but is it a Labor Council meeting?
The National Council on Federal Labor Management Relations.
National Council.
Yes.
What is that, and how often do they meet, and what do they do?
The president appointed a council to work on improving labor management relations in the federal government, and we meet every other month, odd number of months usually, and it's a combination of management people and labor people.
Now, that is a real first, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, there was the partnership council under the Clinton administration, so this is a little different from that, but it's along the same line.
Yeah. Pat, back talking about different administrations, different strokes, when the Bush administration came into power, they set up, they wanted to have a different pay system, and they wanted to have pay for performance in various varieties. And it was set up in the Defense Department, I think, is the National Security Personnel System, NSPS.
Yes,
okay. And they immediately ran into problems because the labor unions, the AFGE, National Treasury Employees Union, and NFFE and others, didn't like the idea, period. They didn't want to participate. And so defense wound up putting people who were, and correct me if I'm wrong, outside of bargaining unit jurisdiction.
Right, and the managers and supervisors.
Okay, so they put them in the NSPS. And how did it work? I mean, did it work well?
I think the application was pretty varied. In some areas it worked very well. In others it didn't work as well.
Some people got substantially higher raises than they would have, or than their colleagues who weren't in SPS did, right?
Absolutely, because it was a pay a range of pay grades as opposed to your standard GS schedule.
And I know some people were suspicious that because it was this particular group, they got better treatment than they would have under regular conditions, and also that the administration wanted to make an example to prove that this was a good system, so it encouraged people to get maybe higher raises than they were entitled to, or certainly that they would have gotten under the other system. What do you say to that kind of criticism?
Well, actually, a lot of agencies were very careful to limit the raises to the pay grades, to stay within the range of pay grades.
Okay. And then this is one of those things, it came in under the Republicans. As soon as President Obama was elected and the Democrats took over, they started unraveling it. Where is it now?
It's gone.
It's gone. And what about
although there are a lot of people that are still on pay retention who did get pay raises that were above their current pay grades.
I've been hearing from some of them by email, and some of them it's quite a convoluted situation. They got raises, and by saved pay, I guess that means when a pay raise comes along, it hasn't happened in 3 years until now, but when a pay raise comes along, they get what, none of it or some of it?
50%.
They get 50%. Also, until they wind up back where they would have been had they not been under the national security personnel system.
Well, until the general schedule pay catches up to where they're at.
But it's a complicated business in government. What are you guys looking at? 2013 was a scary year for much of the time.
Was.
You know, with sequestration, with the furloughs, with the threat of actual shutdown, and yet at the end of the day, it appears that feds got off. Furloughs and shutdowns aside, and they were paid for the shutdown, but feds got off much lighter than many people thought they would.
Yes, they did. A lot of the furloughs ended up being curtailed. I know DOD went down, you know, originally I think it was
22 days, I believe, yeah.
We went down to 6 days. So we did manage to reduce a lot of that. And like you said, the shutdown, there was a back pay bill passed so that we could get paid for those days. So we kind of dodged a lot of bullets last year. I don't know that we'll be so lucky this year.
Well, I've heard it argued both ways. One is that it's going to be much tougher this year because while they seem to have settled the budget problem and signed this, we've got a 3-day continuing resolution going now, or 2 days, I guess, left on it. But that the Republicans, rightly or wrongly, got the most of the blame for the government-wide shutdown, and therefore they learned a lesson, and we're not going to have another one of those. But there are people who say that because it's an election year, the politicians are either going to be too preoccupied to beat up on federal workers the way they have been doing over the last few years. The other school of thought is that they will come after the feds with a passion in order to be able to go to the voters/taxpayers and say, we did something after all. What's your take on it?
Well, President Obama did include the change CPI in his FY14 budget proposal, and the Congressional Budget Office has scored a switch to the CPI as a huge savings, $162 billion over 10 years. So given those numbers, we're very concerned about whether or not they'll bring in the chain CPI.
You said the magic words there. We need to take a short break here, but we'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM, talking with Pat Niehaus, president of the Federal Managers Association. Okay, we're back here on your turn with Mike Causey, and this is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. Reminder that our shows are all archived on our homepage here, so you can listen to them anytime and tell a friend. We need the hits, and we like to communicate directly with you. So check us out and check out some of the past shows as well. Talking with Pat Niehaus, she is president of the Federal Managers Association. She's involved in federal management and labor relations at, did you say Travis Air Force Base, Pat?
Yes.
Travis in California. And she's here for the union management partnership meeting that the system set up by the Obama administration. Pat, before we took a break, you said the magic words chained CPI. And I think to people beyond the Beltway, that almost sounds like a racy novel or a movie. But in fact, the CPI is a consumer price index. And the Consumer Price Index, and there are a number of them, is what the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics uses to track a number of things, including the inflation rate. And currently they use a system, they take a market basket full of goods, they send teams out to various cities around the country, and they say, how much does a can of peas cost? How much does a Hormel ham cost? And what are the prices in Dallas? What are the prices in D.C.? What are the prices in Seattle? And you name it. Then they massage all this data, bring it together, and they come up with it. Is it the CPIW they use?
I think it is.
Okay,
yes,
that's,
that
I'm
not sure.
I think that's CPIW, which stands for workers and urban. But the idea is this is what it costs the average person to buy typical things that people buy on a regular basis. But it also includes things like college tuition. But it's very important because that CPI figure by law triggers an automatic cost of living adjustment, not only for federal retirees and military retirees, but most importantly, in numerically, for people who get Social Security. That's about one out of every six people in the United States who get a cost of living raise, a COLA, every January based on the CPI. And the proposal is to change that yardstick, to change that measuring device to something called the chained CPI. Would you take a shot at explaining that?
The chained CPI, the most common example I've heard to illustrate that is that if the price of beef goes up, they're theorizing that people will buy a less expensive alternative such as chicken or pork. But one of the problems with that theory is that there are some things that are not easily substituted, and especially for retirees, medication is a big issue. That's one of the things that you can't necessarily easily substitute. So with the rising health care costs and no alternatives, I think you'll see seniors may be forced to make decisions between food and prescription drugs.
Yeah, or taking prescriptions every other day instead of daily, as they're supposed to.
Yeah, and they say, you know, they're the people who are proponents of the chain CPI often use, you know, modest or harmless to describe the cuts. But when you add up over a period of time how much that could impact people, the average federal retiree would probably lose an estimate of about $48,000 over 25 years. The average retired military person would lose about $42,000 over 25 years. So that's not, you know, that could be over a year's retirement in a 25-year period.
You know, it's funny you use those numbers. I had lunch yesterday with somebody who retired from the federal government and someone who used to be a lobbyist for a federal organization. And I used numbers like that, and they both looked at me. And I thought maybe I got it wrong, but in fact, those are the estimates. And the idea, I guess the reason for that is compounding in reverse. Under the current system, say I would get a 3% cost of living adjustment. Under the chain CPI, that would be reduced by about 1.3%, I think is the number.
I think so, yeah.
Which doesn't seem like a lot in the scheme of things. But
when you start compounding,
exactly.
It is a lot.
And yeah, you get less each year, and then the next year you get less compounded on less. And you're saying in a 25-year retirement, which is not at all unusual, you'd get $48,000 less, and the retired military would get about $42,000 less.
Yep.
That's astounding. And I think a lot of times when people hear about these things, they think, well, it's the Republican-controlled Congress, the Republican-controlled House that is pushing this. But in fact, the Obama administration has signed on this, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
Okay. So, I mean, if the president wants it, if the House Republicans want it, what's to stop it?
That's a good question. Other than advocacy groups, I don't know.
And I would think that, you know, it's one thing for you as president of the Federal Managers Association to say this is not fair to federal workers. And
it's not fair to anyone.
Well, that's the point. I would think you'd have to sell it based on not fair to anybody. And we're
because it also affects Social Security.
Exactly.
It doesn't just affect those of us who are federal employees. Everybody is.
Yeah, that's the big number, and that's the group that it used to be that Social Security, and it may still be, they called it the third rail of American politics. That is, touch it and you die.
Well, and the supplemental security income benefits for handicapped and disabled people.
Yes.
But, you know, if you're looking at $162 billion over 10 years, that's coming out of the pockets of the people who can least afford to lose it in general.
Yeah, that's an interesting it's one of those things. It depends on where you stand and where you sit. If you say we're going to save $162 billion over the next 10 years, everybody stands up and applauds. That just sounds great. But when you say, by the way, it's coming out of your future annuity, your future
right.
Social Security benefit, then it becomes a very different figure.
Yeah, it depends totally on your perspective.
Yeah. Pat, some of these things I always use the example of Claude Rains, the evil Vichy French inspector in the movie Casablanca, and something happens and he tells his men to round up the usual suspects. But on the federal beat, we have a group of usual suspects that we round up each and every year, not to fake news or make news, but really because they're out there and yet they never seem to happen. One of the big fears among federal workers, as long as I can remember, is that the government will return to the old system it used 20 or 30 years ago, whereby annuities were based on the highest 5-year average salary. That was changed some time back, and it's now the highest 3-year average salary, and that makes a difference, in some cases a considerable difference, in the annuity of people. Now, at a time of no pay raises, such as the last 3 years, that's not quite as important, but in normal times, the difference between a high 5 and a high 3 can be significant. Have you run any numbers on that to show what it would look like?
The estimate that we've seen is that it would reduce annuities by about 3%.
Okay. So, and that's, again, that's a big deal because that reduces your starting annuity. So if you had a starting annuity reduced by 3% and then the future COLAs, cost of living adjustments, were based on the chained CPI.
Yeah, you'd get a double whammy there.
You'd be double hit. Several people have said to me, and this is pure speculation on their part, my part, because we don't know what's going to happen, that if anything is likely to happen this year, they pray it won't be the chained CPI. That's the monster in the swamp that's lurking out there. But they say that this high 3 to high 5, which has been used to scare federal workers for the last 20 or 30 years, that it actually has a shot this year. It might be almost a cosmetic change that Congress put in at the last minute. Does the Obama administration have a position on this?
I haven't seen a position on this from them. I would hope that it won't pass. I think you'll see a lot more CSRS in particular employees retire.
Yeah, Pat,
if that happens.
Good theme. Talking.
I know
about,
personally, I'm a CSRS employee, and I would probably retire before the effective date.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a lot of people say that, and I seriously know people who have been kind of waiting for 4 or 5 years, but if they get any hint that it's going to happen, they would retire. Now, the Obama administration is in favor of higher retirement contributions
right.
on the part of employees. Is that correct?
Yes. They have proposed that repeatedly.
Okay. So there again, now the House Republicans, I think, were looking at a 4% increase. The Obama administration was looking at something like 1.3%, and it would be phased in. But again, the bottom line, as with the change CPI, the bottom line is the White House wants it, the Congress wants it. What's to stop it?
Yeah. Again, other than advocacy and constituents reminding Congress that they work for their constituents, I don't know that there is anything to stop them. One of the things about the change CPI and the high 3 to high 5 change is that I think it will really impact retention of employees that we need to retain.
Well, I've heard that, you know, from many, many people, both email and phone conversations. And there are a number of things. Another factor I think we haven't considered very much here is the retirement tsunami, which was, by the way, first predicted in 1999, it has not yet hit us. It's become a cottage industry in Washington, predicting when it's going to hit and what its impact will be.
Yeah, but, well, us baby boomers are hanging in longer than people thought we would.
Well, that's right. I mean the entire situation has changed. People are working, for whatever reason, people are working longer than they said they had intended to, and in some cases they have to do it, whether it's pay freezes or whatnot. But I'm thinking you have this pent-up group. I mean, people who could go anytime. I assume you could retire anytime?
Yes, I could.
You? Okay. So you have people like you. You're the poster person for that group. People like you, you're in there for a lot of reasons, including the fact that I know you love your job and you like working with the government and with FMA. But the people like that, then you have the FERS people who, until the middle of this month, did not get full credit toward retirement for their unused sick leave. Now, I believe effective January 11th or the 17th, but if it hasn't happened, it's going to happen very shortly. They will now be able to get full credit for their unused sick leave, and that could increase somebody's annuity enough to make it worthwhile.
Absolutely.
And that, I would think, that could maybe jumpstart. We might really have a retirement tsunami after all.
Well, I know several FERS employees who have just been waiting for that to happen.
Yeah, I've talked to them as well. Pat, we need to take a short break here. I'm talking with Pat Niehaus. She's president of the Federal Managers Association and in the Labor Management Office at Travis Air Force Base, California. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Pat Niehaus. She's president of the Federal Managers Association and herself a manager and supervisor in the labor relations field at Travis Air Force Base in California. And she's here for a meeting between the administration, some administration officials and federal representatives of federal unions and organizations. And this is part of a labor management council set up by the Obama administration. I think, Pat, earlier you said they meet once a month, every other month.
Subcommittees that meet throughout the intervening period.
Okay, all right, and it's always on Wednesdays, they say.
Pat, yeah, the third Wednesday.
What's FMA's legislative agenda? What are your priorities for 2014?
One, of course, is the change CPI. That's our most pressing. The retirement issues. We have a lot of our members are eligible to retire and who are concerned about how that will impact them. One of the things that we've been advocating for a long time is extension of the probationary period for employees entering civil service. Some career fields, employees are in training for a year when they start working for the government. So by the time they run through their one-year probationary period, they haven't even done the job yet. They've just been in training. So we are advocating to extend the probationary period to give managers a better opportunity to evaluate employees after they're trained.
That's interesting because the government has a longer probation period than many private sector companies. But one of the arguments, you know, when people say you can't fire a government worker, and they look at the numbers and they see that relatively few people are fired. I mean, many resign or are forced to resign, but the government, the number of people fired is very small in the government compared to the private sector. The counter argument to that is the probation period takes care of a lot of that because they weed people out in that first year when they can be let go for virtually any reason.
Right. But if you, again, if you don't have a person who's actually performing the job, they're still being trained throughout that entire probationary period. You're not able to effectively use that probationary period.
Okay. You're yourself a manager and you head a management group. Are the people coming into government today, are they the greatest generation?
I don't know if they're the greatest generation, but I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of energy coming into the government with the newer employees. We do see a lot of veterans coming into federal service. I know, you know, working for DOD, of course, we hire a lot of veterans. So one of the advantages to that is you have an already trained person coming in to do the job in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I know a lot of places, and I was over the VA recently, and a lot of the people there are veterans, and they say, we're not just doing this to be nice. These are extremely good, disciplined men and women. They're mature beyond their years. They realize when they've got a good thing, and they make very good workers.
Well, absolutely. And for example, I work on an Air Force base where we hire aircraft mechanics. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars to train an aircraft mechanic. If you have one who's already been through all that training while they were in the military, why wouldn't you hire a fully trained person as opposed to someone off the street that you would then have to expend all those funds to train?
Well, that's right. Very valuable commodity, and many of them would have various clearances that would save the government money, too.
And I think the former military people are more aware of the aspects of a security clearance. What goes into having a security clearance than someone off the street?
Budget deal has been signed into law. What does that mean for the stability of federal workers?
Well, for the time being, you know, we at least have a budget to work with. It's when you're going from continuing resolution to continuing resolution, you can't plan as easily as you can when you have a government a budget, whether it's the one you wanted or not. You at least you know, okay, this is what I've got for this year, so I can make my plans.
Okay, and I gather that has been a problem, and people think this is something new, but some senator recently announced his retirement, and he came out with the numbers of the years when all agency budgets have been approved, and it's something like only 3 or 4 years in the last 20 years. So it's a Republican problem. It's a Democratic problem. It's the White House. I know you've been around a long time, and you know everybody who's been in Washington a long time or observing the government says that things have never been worse, that the acrimony on Capitol Hill is at an all-time high. And, of course, we none of us were around in the days when people clubbed each other with canes and had duels
goodness.
Across the river. But it does seem to me to be pretty bad. What's your take on that?
I have never seen it this bad in my years of following politics and the federal government. It just seems like compromise is now a dirty word, where I think that's what the original system was intended to promote.
Do you have any insight as to why it's this way? I mean, I've heard everything from the fact that they take too many vacations, that too many of them leave their families at home, and they don't get to know each other as people. You know, their kids don't play on the same softball team or go to the same schools.
No, I really don't know what causes it. I just wish it would stop.
Something in the water.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this coming up, and I want to ask you, what's happening on the health insurance field, that is the self plus one option that I presume is going to be offered next year?
I think it's next year. It was passed. So the self plus one would add an extra tier into the federal employees health benefit program. Right now we have a self only or self plus family. So if you are just a person with one child or a person with a spouse, you're paying the same as a person with six kids.
One of the arguments, including Walton Francis, who's the editor of the Washington Consumer Checkbook, is that it's a group plan, therefore the young subsidize the old, mm-hmm. the healthy subsidize the unhealthy. And he and others have expressed the fear that this might somehow harm older workers and retirees if there's no difference in prices.
I haven't seen anything to totally support that. I know our members, we've advocated for it for a long time. Our members are very much in favor of it.
Yeah, I think he's afraid that it might draw a lot of people in, and that their premiums will be lower, and it would have to be made up somewhere down the line with older employees. But I guess we'll have to wait to see on that. There's no deadline, as far as you know.
No, I don't know that there is a deadline on that.
Okay, Pat, anything we haven't covered, anything you want to get out there?
No, I just hope that the bill that has been introduced by Representative Cartwright, the Wage Grade Employee Parity Act, will pass. I know that there are other folks supporting that, and I hope that we get to where we can get back to the business of government as opposed to just putting out fires.
Well, that's a good point. And your wage grade people, again, these are skilled mechanics, carpenters, craftsmen, all type. There's only 230,000 of them left in the whole federal government. About one in every 11 employees now is wage grade or blue collar. And they, too, have not had raises in 3 years.
Actually, 4 years, I think.
Is it four? Okay, so
yeah.
That's including this year. So 4 years, and then they're not even going to get, they're not automatically going to get the 1% raise that was effective this month for white-collar employees. So
right.
You think that would gather some steam. Well, Pat Niehaus, thank you again for being with us. Really appreciate it.
And thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with the gang from the Federal Times. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn with Mike Cawley. I'm glad to have you sticking with us here. And now we're one of my favorite parts of the show when I get down in the weeds with the gang from the Federal Times and we talk about what's happening at Ground Truth, as they'd say in the intelligence community. And our guests today are Nicole Blake Johnson and Sean Riley. Folks, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you, Mike. How are you?
Thank you. Listen, our lead story today, and yours too, and I know you've been tracking it, is how this new budget agreement deals with federal workers and retirees. This is the $1.1 trillion thing that was sort of dancing in the dark, hammered out to avoid a yet another government shutdown. What does it look like?
Well, I mean, it looks like, one, it's going to pass. The White House yesterday issued a statement saying, strongly encouraging swift passage of the legislation, which mean essentially that agencies would get their budgets for the rest of the fiscal year. It would also provide a 1% increase, as you were discussing with Pat Niehaus on the previous segment of the show, a 1% increase for wage grade employees. You know, these are the folks commonly described as blue collar. They work at, military depots for the Forest Service, et cetera. And this would put them on par with folks who are covered by the general schedule who have already gotten their increase under the executive order that President Obama issued last year.
So this is sort of a brave new world for us to actually have all 12 budgets approved for a 12-month fiscal year. This has not been the case in the past. And I think talking to people on the Hill, a lot of newer members of Congress who were not around for the 1995-96 shutdown and the aftermath of it learned a very hard lesson in the most recent shutdown.
I would say so. I think it was a chastening experience. And if you look at what happened, I mean, the government was shut down for 16 days. And really, nothing really came out of it. There was nothing, for the folks in the Tea Party who were the primary movers behind that. It really didn't result. They didn't succeed in their objective of stopping implementation of the Affordable Care Act, often known as Obamacare, from taking effect. And because Congress ended up retroactively awarding pay to the hundreds of thousands of federal employees who had been furloughed, what they essentially did was give them a paid vacation. which was probably the opposite of what they would have intended.
Yeah, well, it struck some people almost as a Governor Chris Christie moment there in retrospect, because, of course, he is now taking heat because of the shutdowns on the George Washington Bridge in New York City and New Jersey. And was that intended or not? Did he know it or not? And some people said the same thing about the shutdown. The Congress made a mistake in doing it. And the administration encouraged people like the Interior Department, the National Park Service, to, as some would say, quote, make it as difficult as possible for them, the them being the public, members of the public who came to national parks and were turned away.
Yeah, there's always those. I think I remember hearing those accusations back in the 95, 96 shutdowns. You know, the administration's response is essentially these, you know, their response is governed by law. And they had to follow the law and furlough employees who were seen as not accepted, or in the common common phrasing, non-essential, even though that's I guess frowned upon.
It's a politically incorrect term, but yeah. We know what you mean.
Exactly. So, but in any case, I mean, it didn't. You know, it was not. This shutdown was not popular with the public by any means, and it didn't accomplish what its backers intended it to do.
Particularly, as you say, they didn't even save the salary money they paid people for the 16 days off.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Nicole, what's on your radar screen? What are you working on right now?
Well, just following up on some of the points, Sean was making in terms of the bill, I, you know, was digging in through for IT-related and cyber things, which is more along my lines.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what this bill would provide is about $792 million for cyber efforts, mainly on better securing federal networks and funding this massive continuous monitoring program that Department of Homeland Security is heading up. And essentially, you know, under that program, there's about a $6 billion contract that agencies can use to purchase software tools that would monitor their networks, let them know, you know, what are some of their vulnerabilities, and that would help them to address some of their most severe problems first. So that's definitely a win for agencies who would be able to, you know, get funding through DHS to help stand some of these efforts up.
You know, I often think your growing expertise in IT, Sean and I are going to be working for you probably about 4 or 5 years.
Definitely so. Hiring.
So,
I'll be hiring.
So be kind. Hey, I noticed on your homepage today there's a GSA launches social network for GWACs headline. What's that all about?
Well, that was actually more along the lines of a story Andy was covering, and too bad he's not in here to jump in on that. So I don't have the specific details, but hopefully I can get back to you.
What's GWACs?
That.
It sounds like an early warning radar thing.
Those are basically government-wide acquisition contracts, essentially stood up by, you know, GSA runs one, and there's a couple across some of the other agencies. But they're essentially contracts that would allow agencies from across government to purchase on those contracts.
Normally, we don't deal too much with comings and goings because that's covered in other parts of the paper. But I think there's some significant retirements coming up here. First, Representative Frank Wolf announced he's leaving after 33 years in Congress. And in some ways, and I don't mean this in an unkind way, but it seems like he's been there forever. And then this morning, Representative Jim Moran, a Democrat from Virginia, has announced, I believe, that he's going to be leaving Congress. Now, these are two pillars of the pro-federal establishment, correct?
Oh, yeah, and they're absolutely. And, you know, one was, Congressman Moran's a Democrat, Congressman Wolf's a Republican, but I think they worked fairly closely together, as did, other members of the Virginia and Maryland delegations on issues of interest to federal employees. And it's worth noting that they both had a lot of seniority. Congressman Moran has been in for 12, he's in his 12th term. Both are on the appropriations committees. It's very important. Congressman Wolf chairs the appropriations subcommittee that funds the Commerce, Justice, and departments and NASA. And so they play a very important role in assuring funding for particular agencies and also in being advocates for the federal workforce.
Well, as you recall, when President Clinton took office, the new federal comparability law kicked into action, and the first thing that happened, he took a look at federal pay and said, holy moly, this is a lot of money, and ordered a pay freeze, even though the brand-new law called for a raise that year. And that's when this, I'd call them the four-horse Horsemen of the Apocalypse, but Steny Hoyer of Maryland, Jim Moran of Virginia, a Democrat, and Frank Wolf of Virginia, a Republican, and a couple of other members, and they ran this through the Bush and the, both the Clinton administrations. The Democrats would carry the water when a Democrat was in the White House. The Republicans, Wolf and others, took over when President Bush was in office, and they would always end run the Congress and get federal workers a better pay raise, and that era may be gone.
Well, I think one thing you learn pretty quickly when you cover politics is that individuals do make a difference, and in Congress, the length of time you've been on Capitol Hill makes a difference, both in terms of the seniority you require, and also just in terms of the expertise you require. You know, the issues affecting the federal workforce, you just referenced the Federal Pay Capability Act. These are very technical. Most members don't know anything about them, so they really rely, I think, on members from this area to educate them and take the lead on them.
Well, that's a good point, because a lot of people looking at the flow charts would say in the old days you wanted to be on Post Office and Civil Service Committee and now on Governmental Affairs. And while they do deal with federal employees and get down in the with the nitty gritty, the control is appropriations and leadership, and that's where you've had Moran, as you said, you've had Wolf, and Steny Hoyer being Speaker of the or Majority Leader is not bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and of course, Congressman Hoyer will continue, but there's no question this is a big loss, and particularly since both of these, members of Congress will be leaving at the same time.
This being a midterm election year, and they seem to have ironed out the budget problem, so we're not going to have that fight. What you got any predictions for what kind of year federal workers are going to have on Capitol Hill?
I suspect there won't be a huge amount. I mean, primarily they've been affected the last 3 years by these, repeated budget standoffs. I was talking to someone who lobbies for one federal advocacy organization for federal employees last week, who were wondering, what are we going to do? Because we've gotten so used to these recurrent crises over the last 3 years. So I think for a lot of federal employees, this will come as a relief. There won't be these, assuming this budget bill passes, which it probably will, things are going to be locked in for the rest of the fiscal year, and hopefully, I think from the federal standpoint, for fiscal 2015
we may have to get real jobs. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Sean. Thanks to Sierra Crawford and Julia Ziegler for working the boards today. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.
Thanks,
Thank
Mike.
You.